All right, what we will do is we're going to go back to our work on eschatology. We're going to take a little detour from the book here in a minute, but the lectionary got us to the subject of eschatology. Then we started using Ryrie's book on basic theology. We've done kind of a survey and overview of eschatology. We have done an introduction, survey, an overview of eschatology, a survey and overview of postmillennialism, a survey and overview of amillennialism, a survey and overview of premillennialism, and then that has led us to look at God's covenant with Abraham. We've looked at the importance of the Abrahamic covenant as it relates to eschatology, and we've talked about, you know, that a lot of things come down just to how we understand the Abrahamic covenant. We looked at the promises of the covenant. We looked at the personal promises to Abraham, and those were basically three short clauses. I will make you a great nation, I will bless you, and I will make your name great. Those are the personal promises to Abraham. We looked at the universal promises, the promise of divine blessing or cursing on people on the basis of their treatment of Abraham. Abraham's relationship with God was so close that to bless him or curse him was in effect to bless or curse God. We talked about that. We looked at the promise of that all the families of the earth would be blessed, all right? And then we saw how Christ fits into that, exactly what that possibly means. So those were the universal promises. So the personal promises, the universal promises. Then we looked at the national promises. And the national promises are found in Genesis 15, 18 through 21. And we looked at the promise that Abraham would father a great nation. Was both a personal and a national promise, all right? Did we cover this part? Oh, okay, maybe we stopped before that. Okay, we may have stopped before that. Did we get? We must never got to the national promises. Okay, awesome. I thought we had made it that far. All right, so, good, because I know we started talking about it. So maybe that's why I would assume we got further. I know we started talking about the significance of land with the Abraham covenant, and we've talked about land a couple of times. So we're going to definitely get to that here. It's mentioned in the book under the national promises. So we'll just make this. So we've looked at the personal promises, the universal promises, and now we'll look at the national promises. Okay, all right. So then, yeah, okay. So then that's what we covered. So, all right, so that's what we've done. So now we look to the national promises. So we can look at Genesis 15, 18 through 21. I was assuming we were doing a review there, but okay. That's good that I know where we stopped. Genesis 15. Genesis 15. This at least gets us the text. All right, starting in verse 18, we're going to have a lot here, a name of different things here, so we'll just kind of go through some of this. Genesis 15, starting in verse 18, and the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land. And it starts naming all of the rivers, right? From that river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. Then it names a number of different groups, the Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadamites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Rephaims and the Amorites. And it names all of these different places and people groups and all of those things. So that's the text. And we'll break the text down into this part, all right? So the national promises, the first national promise is the promise that Abraham would father a great nation was both a personal and national promise. So there's a promise that he'd be a great nation. That's the first national promise. Now, that's not specifically laid out in Genesis 15, 18 through 21. That's laid out earlier in Genesis 12. But it's a personal and a national promise. I think that makes sense, right? Okay, yeah, it's to Abraham, so it's personal, but it's going to be a great nation, so there's the national promise, all right? Number two, now this is where I was trying to get to. The promise to that nation of a specific land as an inheritance. the promise to that nation of a specific land as an inheritance. We saw that a little bit right there in Genesis 15, 18. And the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed, and please note, unto thy seed. All right? So that's clearly for his descendants, for the nation. Have I given this land? Now that this land is obviously a specific land, right? I mean, obviously, Abram is not going to understand this to be what? Some symbolic thing or the church or no. He understands that there's going to be land. And then how do we know he's talking about physical land? He gets geographical locations, all right? So clearly, this is physical land being given to them. Everyone would have to acknowledge this. Now, Ryrie gives a number of scriptures here to look at. So I'm just going to, if you'll help me, these are all going to be in Genesis. We'll go through these as quickly as possible, and then you can tell me what you see when you get there, right? So we're going to look for, in these passages, anything directly related to land. The first one is Genesis 12, 7. Okay, I would just give this land, okay? Does he offer any kind of proof of physical land in Genesis 12, 7? All right, okay, so, but there's land. Okay, but this land, space, and I think it's clearly, yeah, Abraham knows what he's referring to there, right? How about Genesis 13, 15? Okay, what's verse 6 say? Okay, there you go. All right. So he's passing through a land, and then he says, this land. So clearly, we know it's physical land. There's no question about it. All right, Genesis 13, 15. All the land you see. He's talking physical land, right? Well, I mean, there's no question about this. I think we can see it. How about, that's Genesis 13, 15. How about look at Genesis 13, 17? Okay, all right. So physical land. There's no question about this, all right? How about Genesis 15? Genesis 15, 7 through 8. All right, so he's contrasting the land he's going to give him with the land he had come from. Clearly, he came from a physical place, and he's going to be given physical land and his descendants, all right? That's Genesis 15, 17, or 7 through 8. Look at verse 18 of, hang on. Let me look here. I don't think it's the whole, hang on. Verse 18 is another promise for land. Yeah, Genesis 15, 18, another promise for land. We just read that one a little while ago, okay? So that's Genesis 12, 7, Genesis 13, 15, Genesis 13, 17, Genesis 15, 7 through 8, and Genesis 15, 18. All land. Now, there's still more, though. Genesis 17, 8. Yeah, and I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee. Please note, I will give unto thee and thy seed after thee. Meaning that this goes beyond Abraham. This is why it's a national promise, right? After thee, the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, this is the key phrase. What's the next phrase? An everlasting possession. And I will be their God, an everlasting possession. And we had this conversation before. What does everlasting seem to imply? Everlasting. And now here we come. Here's where we can get into some major conversations. Okay, first, are all these promises of land, this is very important, are they conditional or non-conditional? If they're non-conditional, then you can't say, well, they got the land and lost it because of their failure No, if it's non-conditional, right, then guess what? They got the land, and if they lost it, that means they have to get it back. For what reason? Because it's an everlasting, all right? So if it's unconditional and it's everlasting, they have to have the land, and they don't have the land. All right? If it's not everlasting, or if it's only everlasting based off a condition they have to meet, then you're like, well, what conditions did they have to meet? And so that would become an issue, because we understand the Abrahamic covenant to be what kind of a covenant? Covenant of grace. So that's where things become really, to me, complicated. Which verse was that? That was 17:8. All right, look at 24:7. Okay, again, but please note how it's to your seed. Like, this is not just to Abraham. This goes to the nation, all right? All right, how about 26:3? That was 24:7. Now we go 26:3. Okay, so once again, land, into the descendants. How about 28:13? Yep. 28, meaning that the land idea is continuing after Abraham, right? 28:13 through 14. What do we have here? Hey, yeah. So we have the seed and we have land. All right, everybody see it? The land whereon thou liest, and to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. Once again, it's future. It's all encompassing. Go to chapter 35. Okay, it's that promise to continue. Go to 48:4. 48. This is not some isolated little thing. Okay, that's the point. Yeah. So yeah, it's passing now. It's being repeated from generation to generation. Right. 48:4. What do we have in 48:4? Oh, there we. So it's mentioned again. That's 48:4 is an everlasting possession. Again, the land is, that's twice. We at least have twice it's being repeated as everlasting, at least twice, probably more, but at least twice. Yeah, now how about chapter 50, verse 24? Yeah, chapter 50, verse 24. All right, so there, so 50:24. All right, so once again, land, and it shows that it's been promised from generation to generation. It's they're going to get the land. So the land has been promised multiple times. All right, Ryrie points out the following, and I'm going to try to skip around some of this because I've got one major goal for this hour, and so I'm going to try to get to that. But I'm just going to at least because some of these things were that Ryrie addresses. We started talking a little bit last week, all right? So let's consider some of these things, all right? Ryrie points out that in Genesis 17, it emphasizes that the land was to be an everlasting possession, which we read, all right? And in chapter 15, verse 18, it describes the boundaries. Look at Genesis 15, 18. See if we can get the boundaries there established. Genesis 15:18. All right, yeah, boundaries as from the river of Egypt to the Euphrates, okay? Now, just so you know, I'm not going to get into all of the technicalities here. Ryrie acknowledges there has been much debate continues on the identity of the river of Egypt. One view quotes it with a different river, another with another river, and then they says that some of these rivers will flow during the rainy season. It flows from the middle of the Sinai Peninsula to the Mediterranean, 90 miles east of the Suez Canal. It gives some scriptures about this river. It says, and they say this is the view of a certain individual. The other view identifies the river Egypt as the Nile, specifically its eastern channel. It says the word used in Genesis always refers to a continuously flowing river, which the Nile is, and some of these other rivers are not. All right? So there's some debate on exactly which river it is. Now, if there's any debate about which river it is, right? If it's any debate, then what does that necessarily mean? We may not know exactly the boundaries of the land, and if we don't know the exact boundaries of the land, then guess what that would mean? It can be very difficult to say if they've ever had it or never had it, because we would need to know the exact boundaries. But this is what Ryrie says. To be sure, in some passages, the focus is on Canaan, or some part of that larger area promised in verse 18. 1 Kings chapter 8 and Ezekiel 47 also mentions some of that part, or at least that area. Now, this is what Ryrie says. Israel has occupied at various times part of the larger area, but never the large area, nor ever as an everlasting possession. So here's what I would say. We can debate forever. They've had the land. No, they didn't have the land. They had the land, lost the land. Whatever you want to say, whatever part of the land they possess, what can we dogmatically assert this morning in 2024? Well, no. Let's not even get into that debate. They did not have it as an everlasting possession. That is what we can be dogmatic about. Because you always have to, in theology or any Bible argument, what you have to try to do is figure out. You can always fight everything, right? Everything is an argument. I don't even know. See, which river is that? The river of Egypt. Is it the Nile? Is it this river? Is it this river? Okay. There's no point in getting into those debates, right? Okay. They had the land. They didn't have the land. That's no even point to get into that debate. What's the ultimate issue? If it was promised to them as an everlasting possession, they don't have it. All right, so that's issue number one. And then, was the promise of the land as an everlasting possession, was it conditional or non-conditional, right? So those are the issues that really are most paramount. But what do I always say when it comes to the land promise? I always say, man, we could drive ourselves crazy trying to figure all of that out. All I need to do is move to the new covenant and see how land is mentioned in that. Because if there is land, because we know the new covenant is made with whom? Israel. Now, I know Christians will yell at me for that, but the text is dogmatic. I'm going to make a covenant not like the one I made with your fathers. Well, that's not us, right? That's Israel. And then he references them as what? The house of Israel and the house of Judah. Everything in those texts about the new covenant says it's with Israel. Now, if God makes a new covenant with Israel, and if land is mentioned, then guess what? It doesn't matter about the land promised in the past. It matters about the land promised in the new covenant. All right? So, Ryrie does not do this. In fact, this is where I think all the books, when it deals with this subject, this is where I believe they mess up. This is what we should go to. We should go to the new covenant. So we're going to spend the next little bit of time that we have going quickly, and we're going to see what we can find out, all right? So we're going to look at the verses in the Old Testament that talk about the covenant, and we're going to try to focus on promises about land and Jerusalem. So we're going to add Jerusalem to this, not only to the land, but to Jerusalem, okay? So the first place we're going to go is Jeremiah 31. Jeremiah 31. because this is a famous passage dealing with the new covenant, right? All right. Jeremiah 31, starting in 31. All right, now a couple of things. We know Jeremiah is a prophet that's dealing with things related to Israel, right? Judah, Israel. So we know that. We know Jeremiah is not sent to go talk about the church. He's talking about the nation, right? He's talking about the judgment that's coming, Babylonian captivity, right? We know all of that. We've talked about Jeremiah. We understand its context. So it's not like we're forcing something in it. Anyone who can just do a book background study can understand the basic context. And in the midst of that context, what happens? Jeremiah 31, verse 31. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. So there's a couple of things established here. It's a new covenant, meaning it's different than the old, right? It's different than the old. And that it's made specifically with whom? House of Israel and house of Judah. Those terms are clearly a reference to the nation, right? And the fact that it says the house of Israel and the house of Judah is even more interesting because in this case, the north is already gone, right? So, and the south is about to go into Babylonian captivity. So this is like, whoa, this is saying, irregardless of what you see, I'm going to make a covenant. You may not know where Israel's at. You may not even be able to see where Judah's at, but rest assured, I know where they are, and I'm going to make a covenant with them, right? Verse 32, now please note, not according to what? The covenant I made with their fathers in the days that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was a husbandman unto them, saith the Lord. Hey, does he acknowledge they broke the covenant? But what is he still going to do? He's going to make a new one. Right? And he talks about bringing them out of the land of Egypt. Now, please note, if he's referring to them and the land of Egypt, we know he's talking about Israel. There's no way to get around this. You can't bring the church into this. It's clearly about Israel. Who was in Egypt? Not the church, the nation of Israel, correct? All right. So he's going to bring them out. Verse 33. All right. But this shall be the covenant I will make with thee, house of Israel. After these days, saith the Lord, I will put my law in their inward parts, write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Now, this is something, obviously, that has never occurred. Right? This has not happened yet. How do we know it hasn't happened yet? How do we know this has never happened yet? Okay, well, just read the verse that I just read. I will put my law in their inward parts and I will write in their hearts and they will be their God and there should be my people. Has Israel ever as a whole all believed in God and trusted in God? No, okay. So this has never come to pass yet. Everybody understand? I know to say that like goes against everything any church you would ever attend would believe, but it's ridiculous. There's no way this has ever happened. When they all came out of Babylonian captivity, did they all believe? Some of them didn't even want to go back. Remember, there was difficulties to get them. And then when they came back, some of them didn't want to do what? Rebuild the temple. We had to send prophets to try to challenge them to do that. And then by the time you open up your Bible to the New Testament, what do you find? They don't believe. It's all like legalism. Everything is a mess, right? In fact, they ultimately kill whom? God, they try to kill God, right? Okay, so clearly something is not, that's not describing it. It has not happened yet. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord, for I will forgive their iniquity and I will remember their sin no more. This is the entire salvation of the nation. It has never occurred. Now, And that part, what's missing? There's nothing about land. So go down to verse 38. Okay, verse 38. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that the city shall be built to the Lord from the tower of Hananel unto the gate of the corner, and the measuring line shall yet go forth over against it upon the hill Gareb, and shall compass about to Goath. And the whole valley of the dead bodies and of the ashes of the fields unto the brook of Kidron, unto the corner of the horse gate towards the east, shall be holy unto the Lord. It shall not be plucked up and nor thrown down forever. All right. Now this is speaking of a city. What city do you think that's referencing? What city? Jerusalem. It's a reference to Jerusalem, okay? Now, there is much debate in how to understand this. Because now this does not have the whole land, but it has something specific to another geographical place, right? Yes, that's a geographical place. Everybody understand those are measurements that are talking about specific places? Okay, right. All right. It's speaking of a place. Now, immediately, you're going to get commentaries that's going to do two things. You ready? This is not literal Jerusalem, and those literal places are all figurative and allegorical and symbolic. So immediately, they're going to go with an allegorical, symbolic approach. Now, what is the problem with doing that in Genesis 31, or in Jeremiah 31, 38 through 40? What's the problem of making that symbolic or allegorical? All the things that come before it, I mean, when he refers to Israel coming out of the land of Egypt, was Egypt literal? Did they come out of literal land? Were they literally delivered? Right? So then, like, if he's referencing things in the past to speak of something in the future, the past understanding would give you the understanding to the future, correct? Wouldn't that be, forget hermeneutics, that would just be logical, right? If I'm talking to you going, hey, I used to live in Buffalo Gap, but in the future, Buffalo Gap, and I start mentioning, you would think that what I'm saying about the future Buffalo Gap, I'm meaning it literal because I'm speaking of my past living in Buffalo Gap, which is in literal, right? So you can't, I mean, that makes no sense to have, I'm speaking of this, all this past stuff in a literal way, but everything I'm going to talk about the future is figurative or symbolic. That does not work hermeneutically. All right, but I'm going to give you two different approaches. All right, here's number one. Are you ready? In Jeremiah 31, 38 through 40, the prophet Jeremiah provides a vivid description of the future restoration and blessings that God promises to bring to Jerusalem and the surrounding areas. The measurements mentioned in these verses are symbolic and convey the idea of vastness and security and permanence of God's presence and protection over the land. So the actual measurements are symbolic. Now look what happens. The measurements are symbolic, but guess what I'm supposed to take as real? The vastness, security, and permanence of God's presence and his protection over the land. So God's presence is literal. His protection is literal, but the measurements are symbolic. Do you see how utterly ridiculous that sounds? If everything is symbolic, then why isn't God's presence seen as what? Symbolic. And what does a symbolic presence of God mean? I don't know. Hey, symbolically, God is present with me. Okay, well, that's great, right? Now, here's a breakdown of the measurements mentioned in Jeremiah, right? They're going to break it down into a number of parts, all right? So here we go. Jerusalem's boundaries are expanded. The measuring line goes out farther in all directions, indicating an expansion of the city's boundaries. This expansion symbolizes the abundance and prosperity that God will bestow upon Jerusalem in the future. So they're like, hey, it's all you need to take from this is that it's expanding the boundaries of Jerusalem, but doing so in a symbolic way. I will argue that based on everything in the text, Jerusalem's boundaries have to be expanded literally for this to make any sense. Not, he's just using these measurements in a symbolic way to say God's going to bless them in the future. No, it would have to mean something. They go to the next. The hill of Gareb, and then it depends on your translation. Some translations have Goath, some just has Goa, right? I think the King James has Goath, and the NIV probably has Goa, right? Right, but the King James has Goath there. Okay, right. All right, now, these specific hills are mentioned as landmarks within the expanded territory of Jerusalem. They serve as reference points to showcase the thoroughness of God's restoration and blessings on the entire region. See, they're just saying they're symbolic. No, you're mentioning literal places, right? Go ahead and grab a Bible dictionary and see if you can find those places mentioned. Yeah, look in the Bible dictionary, see if you can. Well, I don't know. I don't know how the dictionary may use it. It may use to go with the King James, or it may go with yours. So, but the first one is not the Goa. The first one is Gareb, G-A-R-E-B. Okay. Does it give us much? Okay, hill near Jerusalem. Okay, please note, near, not in Jerusalem. Near Jerusalem, okay? Goa or Goath? All right, okay. But please note, please note the dictionary says a promise to rebuild the city. They're connecting it to what's going to happen after the Babylonian captivity. All right, so this is that raises some questions, right? But these are hills near the city. In other words, they're outside the city. Yeah, I know. But I'm saying that they're going to connect the promise. They're going to connect the promise to it being rebuilt. And some will say that these measurements talk about the rebuilding of the city after they come out of Babylonian captivity. I'm going to argue that that's not the case. You know how I know it's not the case? Go back and look at Jeremiah 31. Look at the promise that we just read. Well, let's say that it's not future. Let's say that, well, it would be future for them. If they're coming out of Babylonian captivity, it would be a future promise. But there's a problem with the prophecy. Look carefully at the prophecy. There we go. It was never going to be destroyed. So you can't say that this is a promise talking about what's going to happen after the Babylonian captivity. And why can I say it's not that? Because, yeah, 70 AD is going to be, it's going to be destroyed. So clearly that's not the case. And it's probably been destroyed and experienced many things multiple times since before 70 AD. So there's been all the things that's happened to it since. So that, once again, I think these are specific hills mentioning something that's going to happen. Now, the valley, the whole valley of dead bodies and ashes, this area previously associated with the defilement or destruction will be transformed into a holy place dedicated to the Lord. The cleansing and restoration of the valley signifies God's power to turn despair into hope and life. Again, that sounds so poetic and so beautiful, but we would have to believe there's something much more tangible to it. All right, so far so good, okay. The unmarked graves will be desecrated. This act symbolizes the reversal of the desolation and death that had plagued the land. The desecration of unmarked graves signifies the eradication of past sorrows and the establishment of a new era of blessing and peace. Other places in the land, further measurements and references are given to encompass all the significant locations within the restored land, emphasizing the thoroughness and completeness of God's work of restoration and blessing. Overall, the measurements in Jeremiah 31, 38 through 40, 38 through 40 serve as a symbolic language to convey the extent, security, and permanence of God's restoration and blessing upon Jerusalem and the surrounding regions. They depict a future of abundance, protection, and holiness under God's sovereign care. Well, no, Look, you can't make all of these things, on one hand, legitimate, but make all the language symbolic. It's literal language talking about a literal future that Jerusalem has never experienced, because if they experienced it, one, the city would have to be within those measurements now, and it's not, and two, it would have never been destroyed. So therefore, it's never occurred. Now, one more commentary. I know people are arriving for the next hour, but we got to finish at least this part, all right? All right, here we go. You ready for this? All right. Look at Jeremiah 31:38. It says, the city shall be built to the Lord, right? I think it says that. 31:38? Right? The city shall be built to the Lord. This cannot mean, this is how one commentary puts it, this cannot mean the city built after the return from Babylon, for two reasons. They offer two reasons why it cannot be referring to that city. I've already given you what I think is the reason. But number one, this is to be much greater in extent. In other words, the measurements for the city would preclude this from being the city that was rebuilt after they came out of Babylonian captivity, because the measurements here are too great. And then they never fulfilled that. But two, to me, the number one way is look at Jeremiah 31:40. It is to be permanent, never to be thrown down. Clearly, that cannot refer to that, all right? It must therefore mean, it, if taken literally at all, the city that is to be built by them when they are brought into the fullness of the Gentiles. The Tower of Hananel, this stood in the northeast part of the city. From thence, the wall proceeded to the corner gate, probably the same as the old gate, thus named for its running out into an angle in that part. All right, and I look at 31:39. Until the hill Gareb and Goath are out of the limits of this city. The latter, now I don't know if we can be dogmatic on this. Goath, some suppose it to be Golgotha. That is the heap of Gotha, which being the place where our Lord was crucified, was without the city. These hills were a little to the north, at northwest of the old city walls. They're destined to be within the new city. So wherever these hills are, they were outside and they're destined to now be inside, meaning the city will be expanded to encompass them. Right? I think that makes sense. Look at 31:40, the whole valley of the dead bodies, the valley of the son of Hinnom, and all the fields unto the brook of Kidron, unto the corner of the horse gate towards the east, all these places, the fuller's field, shall be consecrated to the Lord and become part of this new city, so that this will appear to be a city much more extensive than the city of Jerusalem ever was, and to be suited to that time, when the people shall have the law written in their hearts, and God shall have filled the land with the seed of man and with the seed of beast. And then they say, make speed ye happy time. So they offer the idea that, hey, this is what they are looking for. Now, Jerusalem has never been that. So if we talk about these promises of land, any promises of land, there seems to be a connected with the new covenant, a promise about land, specifically in Jeremiah, to which land? The city of Jerusalem. And that the city of Jerusalem is going to have to be expanded beyond what has ever been known before, and clearly what is currently, I mean, they don't even have control of the current city. I mean, the city is broken into three distinct parts, right? The Jewish section, some call it the Christian section, and then the Muslim section, right? The Islamic section, right? So the city is divided, I mean, big time, right? All right. So in some ways, they don't even really, I mean, they don't even have control over the Temple Mount, right? So, like, the whole thing is a mess. So clearly, this has never happened. And so I don't care what anyone says about land in the past. There's a promise about land right there in Jeremiah 31 that is directly to Israel. They've never had it, meaning they will have to. And when is this going to occur? We don't know when it's going. The only place we can put it is where? The millennial kingdom, right? That's, and where Christ will be ruling and reigning? In Jerusalem, right? And then Jerusalem will be expanded. And then God will fulfill his promise to Israel that all Israel will be saved, their law will be written in their hearts, and well, then we have it, all right? So, like, that's the only, I mean, Now, there's still a problem with that, just so that we know. I know we're out of time, but just so that you know, there's still a theological problem with that. Why is there still a theological problem with that being fulfilled in the millennial? Nobody can think of a reason? Don't forget the church. Because what happens at the end of the 1,000 years? That's where a problem arises. Now, we do know that there's supposed to be a new Jerusalem. So then, when we have a new heaven and a new earth, are we going to have a new Jerusalem that fulfills those boundaries? And on the new heaven and the new earth, will Israel still then have the land? I don't know, because all these everlasting things, we talked about this problem before. It's very difficult to know what to do, right? But I know there's going to be a new earth, and it seems like to be a heavenly Jerusalem. I don't have any good answers. It is confusing, right? So on one hand, we say it has to be literally fulfilled. I do believe it has to be literally fulfilled. But the only problem is this literal fulfillment will only last for 1,000 years. Now some will say, but new heaven and a new earth, it still will be everlasting. So I don't know. What does that look like? I know, but in some ways it would have to be like the old stuff if you're going to fulfill these promises, right? It would have to be a Jerusalem that meets these criteria, at least at minimum. And then Israel would they still have the land? Like, I don't know how that works. Like, I don't have a good answer there. And that's usually an all-millennialist argument. It's like, well, see, it's not going to last anyway. Well, I do agree that I don't know. Look, here's what I know. God made a promise. I have to see a literal fulfillment because I can't understand the text without it. What God decides to do at the end of the 1,000 years, that's his problem, okay? That's not my problem at that. You know what I'm saying? Hey, it was fulfilled for 1,000 years. Look, what happens at the end of the 1,000 years, you and God can negotiate. Wait a minute. Are you really fulfilling this? God can be like, yeah, I'm still fulfilling it because it's just going to be on the new earth. It's going to be this, like, I don't know how we work that. All I know is for me to understand my Bible, when it talks about Egypt and Israel and coming out of the land, that the promise has to be literal or I can't understand anything. So from a hermeneutical standpoint, I have to at least get us to the 1,000 years, literal land, literal Jerusalem, literal temple, literal fulfillment. At the end of that 1,000 years, I just kind of wash my hands of it and going, I don't know what to do with that. But I do know that it speaks of a new Jerusalem and a new earth. Can those promises just be transferred over to the new Jerusalem and the new earth? If they can be, then all right. But I don't know what else to do other than that. But I'm willing to acknowledge the difficulty. I just think that difficulty doesn't make it easy to go back and go, well, Israel isn't Israel, Jerusalem isn't Jerusalem, land isn't land, because then that destroys my entire ability to interpret the Bible moving forward. So that's that. At least that gets us there. So that didn't get us to all the land issues, but we at least now see in Jeremiah 31, you may not have land specifically like we've talked about, but that's a specific city, specific measurements. So your land is still somewhat associated with it. All right, we'll have to stop there. All right, Lord God, we come before you this morning. Lord, we thank you for, well, having a place that we can come to question these things, struggle with these things. There's so much we do not understand, Lord, but I hope and pray that our attempt to stay consistent with our hermeneutic and consistent with your word is something we will continue to do no matter where we are. And we ask this in Jesus' name. And God's people said,